Shalom and welcome to the Israel Policy Pod. I'm Neri Zilber, a journalist based in Tel Aviv and a policy advisor to Israel Policy Forum. We have a great episode for you this week with our regular check-in with Israel Policy Forum's very own Chief Policy Officer, Michael Koplow, and Shir Efron, IPF's Diane and Guilford Glaser Foundation Director of Policy Research, where we'll be discussing the state of play in the Gaza War, Israel's two big war aims and whether they're now in conflict, the overall diplomacy surrounding the war, including the humanitarian situation, and much more. There's a lot going on a whole host of fronts, so we'll try to make some order out of the chaos for you. But before we begin, I wanted to ask you all for a small favor. Please, please take a moment to rate us on the podcast app of your choice. The powers that be tell me this helps. 5 stars, please. There are, according to our count, millions of you out there. Don't quote me on that. But even if just a few of you go and click on the 5 stars, that would be really, really helpful. I'll wait. All right, let's get to Michael and Shira. Hi, Michael. Hi, Shira. Welcome back to the Israel Policy Pod.
Thanks, Neri.
Thanks, Neri. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Shira.
So, a lot to discuss this episode, but first things first, how is everybody doing and feeling now 3 weeks into the new year and closing in on 4 months to the war? Shira, how are you doing?
You know, it's... I think, unfortunately, and, you know, you live in Israel too, these are very, very difficult times here. This war is difficult. Fatalities are, the numbers are really high, obviously on the Palestinian side, much higher, but there are also a lot of casualties on the Israeli side. There haven't been any positive signs from the hostages since the last deal. You know, Israeli citizen residents by the Gaza, the bordering communities by Gaza and also in the north cannot return to their homes. This is really just like intolerable situation in the north, which is below the war threshold, but very dangerous. And Israeli politics, as usual, doesn't offer any silver lining either. So, you know, we're hanging in there, and I'm very blessed that everyone in my family is doing okay. But I think for Israel as a nation and obviously for Palestinian friends and others in this region, these are not the easiest times.
No, to say the least. And the way I explain it to people on the outside, there are at least 3 active fronts, quote unquote fronts going on right now. Gaza, obviously, the north with Lebanon, Hezbollah, also the domestic political front. And that's not even before we begin talking about the West Bank, which is not often in the news because of Gaza and Lebanon. So I agree. Difficult days, trying days. Michael, how are you doing with all of it?
I'm doing okay. It's obviously a different vibe here, not in Israel. And so everything lands a little bit differently when you're a step or two removed. But what's going on in Israel, what's going on in Gaza, what's going on in the West Bank is obviously dismaying. And on the U.S. side of the ocean, now that we're speaking on Wednesday morning, or Wednesday afternoon, rather, the day after the New Hampshire primary, we have the seeming Republican coronation of Donald Trump now officially wrapped up, even though we all knew this was coming. So that doesn't put me in a great mood either. But I do have to say that for the first time in a while, I have a little optimism on the Israeli side of things, because I do think that the seams in this government are starting to show more, not just between Netanyahu on one side and Gantz and Eisenkot on the other, but I think some of the seams within Netanyahu's natural coalition of 64 are also starting to show. And while I don't expect the government to fall tomorrow, for the first time in a while, it seems to me that there is light at the end of the political tunnel where you can envision a process by which this government will be replaced and, you know, maybe even have elections at some point late summer or early fall before the Chagim. Doesn't seem impossible to me anymore. So I have a little bit of optimism on that front, just because this government is, from my perspective, pretty terrible and failing its citizens, and I would like to see somebody else there. So I have a bit of optimism, but yeah, so overall, I think I'm still in a pretty gray mood given how things are going.
Gray mood, and not only because of the weather in D.C., from what I hear, according to reports.
Correct. Not only because of the weather in D.C. and the Arctic chill that finally ended today.
And this wasn't meant to be an episode about Israeli politics, but I should say that I spoke to someone earlier this week who also said that elections are more than likely in the coming months, that it won't be tenable for Netanyahu to actually keep this coalition together, whether Benny Gantz and Gaya Eisenkot and their party stays in the coalition or not, that the notion that Netanyahu can just either fight the war, end the war, and just continue on won't actually be sustainable because of just political gravity, mass demonstrations at some point. And this person, who's fairly knowledgeable, told me Netanyahu himself may actually go for snap elections to dissolve his own government, as he's done numerous times in the past, contingent on him actually gaining some kind of major achievement on the battlefield in Gaza. So we shouldn't rule that out either, that Netanyahu may sense an opportunity, or maybe he also understands that time isn't working in his favor, which is actually counterintuitive, to what we and others think, that, well, he just will cling to power for as long as possible and, by correlation, keep the war going for as long as possible to maintain power. But we digress to Israeli politics, naturally. I actually wanted to start off and discuss the war itself in Gaza and how it's going. As Jira mentioned, obviously a very difficult week here in Israel to be asking this question. On Monday, 24 IDF soldiers were killed, including 21 reservists, in one very tragic incident near the Israel-Gaza border. We should also mention that the IDF is now fully in the third stage of the war, what's called the lower intensity phase. More raids, less forces inside Gaza, basically only two divisions inside Gaza, where at the height of it, there might have been more than three. Although we should also mention there is a major division size operation still going on right now as we speak in the southern city of Khan Yunis, a pretty significant operation. So, Michael, we'll start off with you. How are you feeling about the actual war, given that the two main objectives set out by Israel at the outset, destroying, dismantling, toppling, pick your adjective, Hamas, and returning all of the remaining 136 hostages, both objectives have so far not been achieved?
Right. Both those objectives have not been achieved. And I think that makes it difficult to feel anything but kind of muddied about the war. There's, of course, been this debate from the beginning about the two objectives and to what extent they operated cross-purposes to each other and to what extent the war and only the war is going to secure the return of the hostages. I've been deeply skeptical, literally since October 7th, about the idea that these two things could just operate in concert. I think that there was always going to be a trade-off between the two. Certainly, in terms of the evidence that exists, the IDF so far has recaptured or secured the release of one hostage in an operation. All the other hostages that have come back have been through negotiations. We've obviously seen certainly one very visible tragedy in which the IDF killed three hostages by accident. I can't say this with certainty. I think it's reasonable to assume that there are other hostages that have, again, inadvertently and tragically, been killed in the course of IDF operations. And it doesn't seem as if the military pressure on Hamas leadership is leading it to moderate or scale back its demands for what it wants in terms of a deal. So there's that aspect of it. And on the issue of the hostages, obviously, every day that goes by is another day that they are put in greater danger given what we can assume about their health and their welfare. So mm-hmm. it's hard to be terribly optimistic about what has taken place so far with regard to that aim. And in terms of the second aim of destroying, degrading, whatever term you want to use with regard to Hamas, there too, I think there's a mixed record. So yes, the IDF has shifted into this new phase, but it seems from events that we've seen over the past couple of weeks that it is not indeed in full control of the North. We, of course, had the terrible incident on Monday with 21 soldiers being killed in one incident when the RPG hit the building that they were wiring for explosives, and 24 overall that day. And the big accomplishments that Netanyahu, I think, wanted to have to chalk up, the capture or killing of Yahya Sinwar, obviously that has not happened yet, or top Hamas leaders. It seems, based on the IDF numbers, that somewhere between a quarter and a third of Hamas fighters that were in Gaza before have been killed. That's obviously not a small number. We're talking about 9,000 or 9,500 Hamas fighters. But given how intensely Israel has been in Gaza in terms of airstrikes, in terms of the initial 350,000 soldiers who were there, that also doesn't seem like a huge number on, I think this is day 110. So, it's hard. Obviously, there have been some real accomplishments, but I think it's hard, at least for me, to sit here and say the war is going swimmingly and Israel is accomplishing everything it wanted. And this is where we would have expected Israel to be 110 days in, or where we would have wanted Israel to be 110 days in. And that's before we get to the devastating impact on Palestinians in Gaza and the humanitarian issues. So I'm not feeling great about it.
That's the prevailing mood also in Israel, with the caveat that even the Israeli war planners and the generals were very clear from the outset that this would be a very long campaign. So not 6 days, not a month, not even 2 months, but we're talking a year plus in terms of the campaign. Open question whether it will actually be allowed to run that long. Shira, how are you feeling about the war so far, especially given, as you know, because you live in Israel as I do, that the debate has somewhat shifted, I'd say, over the past 2 weeks, where there are growing questions about whether the two big war aims, right, dismantling Hamas and rescuing all the remaining hostages, are now in opposition or, like Michael said, now really harming each other.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Michael. I think I don't know that they weren't in conflict even beforehand, right? Hard to speak about the counterfactual, and we don't know in a world that if we could have gotten the hostages back without the military pressure. So let's give it credit that it helped achieve the first deal. But the facts are that since that previous deal that, when we had hostages come back
in late November,
the military pressure has not achieved any sort of progress, and we're only getting more and more reports of hostages that are no longer alive, with really horror movies posted by Hamas. And it's not just us saying it, right? You had a former chief of staff, now cabinet member, Gadi Eisenkot, in a really incredible interview to Israeli TV channel. He also lost his son, his youngest son, in Gaza. And he was saying there's not going to be any Entebbe opera, right? Like, mm-hmm. The hostages are just going to come back with, there's going to be a deal. I mean, all of the IDF special units, they're all, and many of them, they're all in Gaza, and maybe there'll be a miracle and they'll stumble upon something and be able to rescue. But the chances are so slim, right? Hostages are going to come back only if there is a deal. And maybe there's some rationale that Hamas, given the military pressure, will cave in and agree to a hostage deal. But this is where you know, we have a conflicting objectives here, because I think most of the Israeli public, I mean, of course, most of the Israeli public, there are a lot of people in the public that says, like, do whatever you need to bring the hostages home.
That's what the relatives of the hostages.
But on the other hand, if you look at public opinion, they don't want to stop the war.
Yeah.
And Hamas wants to stop the war. But I mean, you know, I don't know, because it's really just a tragic week. It's hard because, you know, you said it's a mixed bag so far, and there's been some progress. Obviously, there are achievements, but they're not visible, you know. I think the Israelis, and not just the Israelis, I think also regional countries and maybe Israel supporters outside. I don't know if you have Sinwar or Hamadef or some Hamas leaders in Israeli hands to show some major achievements that would give some boost and some could encourage people here, because the sense here and the mood is sort of like, What are we doing? What are we achieving? And at what cost? And this is the prevailing mood here, although it doesn't lead to anyone saying, or to most people saying, and most leadership certainly doesn't say that, not in the IDF, that we should sort of reassess. No one's saying that, but clearly the doubts are, there are doubts, I think.
I agree. And for the first time, I think probably since the start of the war, since the awful events of October 7th, that there are major questions about, say, continuing the war, or at least perhaps countenancing the possibility of ending the war in return for the release of all the hostages. Now, I'm about to say something controversial, because I've never, well, I don't want to say never, but I rarely defend Bibi Netanyahu and Bezalel Smotrich, either in public or in private, for that matter. But I think they both actually told the Israeli public the truth this week when they got up and said that a deal now, as the hostage families and many others here are rightfully demanding the government at least consider, a deal with Hamas would require ending the war and likely withdrawing the IDF from Gaza. That's Hamas's demands. And given the fact that they're literally holding the hostages very close to them, I don't see how you can relent, even if you do find the hostages and the leadership of Hamas, if you're Israel. So really, that's the cost. That's the price that a deal now, as it's termed, would actually cost. And so they got up and said that. And I think even now said, you know, whoever is in favor of that should get up and tell the Israeli public that. Now, an interesting poll came out from our friends at the Israel Democracy Institute earlier today. I think it's the first public poll gauging this question. Would you be willing to agree to a hostage deal to get all the hostages out in return for halting the war? And 60% of Israeli Jews said no, they wouldn't agree to that deal. Now, a slight majority of left-wing identifying Israeli Jews said they would support that deal. But it's not an overwhelming majority, despite what we've heard from opposition politicians, and you know, the media definitely is on that page, and even Gadi Eisenkot to a certain extent, although he in that interview just said that, well, he'd be willing to agree to, you know, halting the war for a few weeks, you know, a month or two. So again, that would be the cost. And I think that's really the sticking point in terms of another hostage release deal. Am I missing something, Michael? What do you think? Yeah.
I guess, so yes, I grant that. And I'll give you the free pass on saying something nice about Smotrich. BB's a different story.
It's a good thing this isn't on the record going out to anybody that has access to a podcast. But I happen to believe what I just said is true.
So, yeah. No.
Tell me why I'm wrong.
No. I think that's right. I guess the problem is that a lot of this conversation is happening in a very binary way, right? Where it's either a complete deal that secures the release of all the hostages at once, which will require Israel stopping the war forever and taking all of its troops out of Gaza forever, or for the foreseeable future, or it's keep on going exactly as everything is and hope that waging the war full stop will at some point create enough pressure on Hamas that they roll back on their demands, or they capitulate, or whatever it is. And to me, there is a middle ground, which is, with all respect and absolute deference to the hostage families, I'm not sure that I would support, I certainly wouldn't support, if I were an Israeli, a deal right now that got all the hostages out if it meant that Israel had to withdraw from Gaza completely, and it also meant releasing every single Palestinian prisoner.
A significant amount of Palestinian prisoners with blood on their hands.
To me, that would be a no-go. But I also think that just like the last hostage deal, any future hostage deal is going to be done in phases. And it seems to me that there is a world in which it seems, based on the reporting and from everybody I've spoken with, that there can be a deal that secures the release right now of some of the living hostages, not all of them, in return for whatever it is, a 2-week pause or the pullback of the IDF to a certain line inside of Gaza. And that's the sort of thing that to me is worthy of consideration, especially if out of 132 hostages, the IDF has already confirmed that 28 of them are dead. I think probably the three of us would agree that the number is likely more than that. So if you can get living hostages out in return for some sort of concession that does not absolutely end the war, does not mean that the IDF has to withdraw from Gaza, that does not mean releasing Palestinian prisoners with blood on their hands, that's the sort of thing that, even though we don't have a poll on this, at least not that I've seen, my guess is that a majority of Israeli Jews would be in favor of, and just makes sense to me, especially when you think about the fact that these timelines for these objectives are not the same. When you have at best 104 living hostages and probably fewer, there's an imperative to do everything you can to get them out quickly, because literally every day that goes by, I think we have to assume that fewer of those hostages are alive. Whereas, as you rightly pointed out, Neri, the war against Hamas, nobody expected to, be 2 months or 3 months and that's it. It's in whatever form it takes in the future, it's going to go on for a while. So these aren't equal or equivalent timelines. And I think that's what I have difficulty with. That's what I'm struggling with. The timeline for hostages is very different. And so I think it's worth doing or considering things that maybe people wouldn't have done or considered a few months ago, if it means getting people who are alive back out of Gaza.
Shira?
Yeah, I 100% agree with Michael. And, there's like a starting position, right? Israel has a starting position. Hamas has a starting position. And what Hamas wants, a complete cessation of hostilities and every prisoner. This is their starting point, but this is not what a deal would actually look like. And I'm going to add to that. First of all, I 100% agree. The clocks are ticking in reverse orders, and if someone has an interest to extend the war, the hostages, they just don't have time. Every day there is really hell on earth, and we have to do what we can to get them out. And there's a question, if we're talking about stopping the war or a humanitarian, this is also the poll that you refer to. If you frame it as a temporary humanitarian pause that could take 2 months, I don't know that, you'll get the same objections. And just as well as I do, that the Israeli public, there's like a tipping point, right? The mood here can shift in a second. There can be a few more Hamas videos or a few more protests, and it is going to change. I actually think there's going to be more public support for the families' struggle, especially if we don't see any achievements on the battlefield. But I think there's extra dimensions we need to speak about here. First of all, when the war is not going as well and it's very difficult, and we're looking at the images from Gaza and the amount of like rubble and ammunition and digging and tunnels and soldiers. I mean, there is a theory of military analysts that a pause, getting out a little bit, clearing the land a little bit, could help Israel militarily in the next stage, which is supposed to be much more targeted, right? You also have, we don't have unlimited numbers of soldiers. They need to be refreshed. You don't have unlimited quantities of ammunition. We can talk about what it means for the U.S. side. This could you know, in a weird turn of events, but because this could actually serve Israel's war aims to the extent that Israel can return to fighting and make the final transition to stage C, is the third stage of the war, which, like, we're supposedly in, but not fully, right? It's supposed to be more like standoff.
Well, that was the ideal plan.
So sorry, and I'll just add to this another issue. We're not talking about the north now. We're just talking about Gaza, but I want to add two fronts. First of all, we have the northern front. We have an untenable situation where you have dozens of thousands of people in the north cannot go back to their homes, but in a sense, but there's no war there. And we know that Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah leader, is not going to cave in and agree to a diplomatic solution. And he has the Lebanese state behind him, saying that only when we stop the war in Gaza, they will negotiate moving the Radwan, the special forces, to the distance that was agreed on in a UN Council resolution post-2006 war. And so in a sense that if you can frame it as a temporary pause, and I agree, I also think the fight against Hamas needs to continue. It gives you the space, and it gives the U.S. and the French the space to start negotiating something in the north so the people in the north can come back to, and we avoid a war with Hezbollah, which we really shouldn't be. You know, no one here, most people in Israel do not want a war with Hezbollah, which would look very different and would be destructive for the state of Israel. So that's another thing. And I want to bring in another wrinkle. We are not speaking about the West Bank now, but the West Bank, we've been saying it for a long time, but it's really tittering on the brink. Mm-hmm. With, I can't even, if we have time in this podcast, we can speak about it, but with the fiscal situation and deficit and percentages of unemployment that we haven't seen in the West Bank, and with Ramadan approaching, you need to calm things down so you don't have additional fronts. So in a sense, I think if you can get live hostages back, you can reorganize your war effort in Gaza, try to like de-escalate in the north, and maybe the cherry, you know, cherry on top is that also shakes the coalition. That would be another bonus. But I think it could be good for Israel all around.
So I don't disagree with you two. And I was positing the debate here in Israel. And again, I can see the merits in both arguments, including, by the way, Netanyahu and Smotrich's positions, at least leveling with the Israeli public about what it would be cost. But I think a partial deal done in phases where Israel can return back to fighting after 2 months, even Netanyahu would agree to that. But that's not what Hamas is demanding. Now, if Hamas lowers its demands, fine. But I don't think they have any interest or even strategic logic in lowering those demands, because this is existential for them, right? This is, the hostages are their insurance policy, and they follow Israeli politics and society just as closely as we do, Yahya Sinwar does. And he sees the debate, and he says, okay, all I have to do is wait another 2, 3, 4 weeks, or even 2 months, and eventually the Israeli public will cave, the government will cave, and they'll agree to my demands. I don't think he has any interest in cutting a partial deal. Not to mention the fact that, as Michael did, the very very saddening math in terms of the hostages, right? If we're talking about maybe less than 100 hostages that are still alive, how many phases do you actually have to play with? If the deal that was struck in November, late November, that was, I think, over 100 Israeli hostages over the course of a week. That's essentially more than what he has right now, if you exclude the Israelis who are no longer amongst the living. So again, I don't want to take sides in this debate. I just want to lay it out for our listeners, because to my mind, that's an honest debate about the merits and demerits of taking a deal, agreeing to a deal or not.
That may be right, Neri. But then, quite frankly, the honest position of the Israeli government, or you know, at least of the part of the Israeli government that that is taking a more hawkish tone on this, the honest position would be to say, listen, there is no deal that will get the hostages back that we can agree to. It doesn't exist. It's not going to happen in phases. It's not a matter of more negotiating. We're not going to get the hostages back. And so in light of that, we are going to prosecute this war to the hilt as if there are no hostages, because that's the more honest position. I mean, the insistence that these two aims, hostages and defeating Hamas, are in no way in tension, and that the latter only supports the former, and that the military operation is only going to ensure that the hostages come back more quickly. There's no evidence for it. And I don't agree with the all for all position, get all the hostages back now in return for every Palestinian prisoner. I don't think that's wise. At least the mm-hmm. people who advocate that are being honest about what it is they're advocating for. And to me, the honest position on the other side would be to say, you know what? There is no good way to get the hostages back. It's just not going to happen. And so we're going to go with the other aim as much as we can.
Yeah. And again, it's worth being proactive and, like Shira said, at least trying to put forward your own position and seeing maybe through the mediators, either the Qataris, Egyptians, or the Americans, that maybe like in late November, you can find some middle ground. I just personally am skeptical that middle ground could be found given what I laid out. But I'm happy we engaged in this debate. Shira, did you want to add anything?
I mean, I think one of the things, and I'm trying to stay away from Israeli politics, but the main issue is not, it's not the public. It's that I think the prime minister, you know, anything that could put his coalition at risk.
Bingo.
He's disincentivized to put forward. And so anything that looks like being weak, and I think Itamar Ben-Gvir is gaining in polls, and he could even like at the expense of Likud. So he's looking for a reason to leave the coalition, right? He needs an excuse.
Yeah. And
I don't know that Netanyahu wants to give him that excuse.
Yeah. I mean, you raised an interesting point that I didn't want to delve into the pure cold political calculations of Netanyahu and others, where I don't think Netanyahu could go for an all-for-all deal, but he would immediately lose his coalition and he would be forced into an election trying to defend the fact that, he just stopped the war. Whereas in my mind, he wants to run in any snap election, if he calls it, like I laid out earlier, as the person who wants to continue the war, but he's being held back by Benny Gantz, Gadi Eisenkot, the generals, etc., the Biden administration. I think that's what he's aiming for. So again, I don't think that he himself thinks he has the political space to actually go for that kind of deal, but that's a different story. And he would lose his government immediately, as Ben-Gvir and Smotrich have threatened. Okay, we'll be right back after this brief message.
As Israel pushes forward with its war in Gaza and grapples with political turmoil at home, Israel Policy Forum experts have been providing timely, clear-headed, and sober analysis on the ongoing conflict. In this week's Koplow column, Chief Policy Officer Michael Koplow unpacks Netanyahu's campaign against Palestinian statehood and outlines what policies the Prime Minister should actually pursue if security, rather than his political future, were his priority. Our Israel at War Hub now includes new explainers on the role of Arab states, the involvement of Iranian proxies across various regional escalations related to the war in Gaza, and an interactive map of the Israel-Hamas war starting on October 7th, in addition to all of our recent analysis. Links to these resources can be found in the show notes of this podcast. If you rely on Israel Policy Forum for credible and thoughtful analysis, please make a gift today so that our work can continue to have an impact. Donate now at ipf.li/supportthepod or at the Support the Show link in the show notes.
Moving on to, I think, even a more depressing topic, but a very, very important topic, which is the humanitarian situation inside the Gaza Strip. Obviously, quite dire, and obviously a lot of people rightfully concerned about that. Shira, what can you tell us about both the reality on the ground inside Gaza, as you understand it, and maybe possibly and hopefully future plans to ameliorate the humanitarian situation inside Gaza?
You know, there's been initially with the onset of the war, the humanitarian situation deteriorated severely in Gaza, and we can, if we go back, even, you know, October 6th, Gaza was a basket case, right? Mm-hmm. With terrible infrastructure and power that only lasted half the day, maximum of 12 hours a day, and most population that suffers from food insecurity, not hunger, just not having the right nutrition, and water that was for the most part. What do we say? Not suitable for human consumption, and a variety of other, you know, indicators that some people would say that Gaza was on the verge of a humanitarian crisis even before October 7. And then the temporary, I think the humanitarian pause of late November, it did temporarily alleviate the situation because there was, you know, an increase in the entry and availability of like food and clean water, and you had fuel and some hygiene stuff and temporary shelter materials. And in a sense, the levels that we saw during the humanitarian pause were supposed to be temporary. We are seeing an increase in the number of items entering Gaza. So I think Israel really deserves the credit for it, for, you know, under pressure, but doesn't matter. Israel opened another crossing, Kerem Shalom, which was the major crossing of goods into Gaza before the war. And now we have over 200 trucks go into Gaza every day, whereas initially it was just a few dozens, right? Mm-hmm. So we have over 200, I think yesterday were 220. I mean, I don't remember the exact numbers, but the numbers keep climbing. There's been a deal with the U.S. to import some flour through the Ashdod port. Israel did open two water pipes to supply water from the Israeli Water National Water Company to Gaza, and fuel is more now available for some of the hospitals. And Israel will tell you, well, we are doing everything we can and the humanitarian situation improves. The thing is that Israel is certainly doing more, mm-hmm. But the humanitarian situation is not improving. And there are a variety of reasons for that. But first of all, there's like just the sheer quantities. If you took a look at the numbers of trucks that entered Gaza on it per day before the war, we're talking about twice that number. It's around the 400, 500 trucks. And also in terms of the composition, what goes in. There's private sector activity that is not really working at the moment. It's at the minimal. Very limited amounts of fuel. And the main bottlenecks, when we were talking about sort of like how do we import stuff into Gaza, we understand now the main bottlenecks are inside Gaza. It's very difficult to store, distribute, and protect aid and aid workers inside Gaza. And I can throw like a few examples to you, but I found out that there are around 150 trucks all over Gaza that are usable. Not all of them. Yeah, not all of them are in good condition also. So if you, the method that's being used is called back to back. So you like take an Egyptian truck, you offload the cargo, you load it onto a Palestinian truck, and then it goes to a warehouse or it goes distributes like the supplies to shelters or wherever. Right. But even if you got in 1,000 trucks without increasing the number of trucks inside Gaza, that's going to be a problem. There's also the issue of shelter and protection of the aid, the supplies itself, and the workers. We are seeing those images. You're probably getting the videos of either a theft by Hamas or just looting by the public. And it really puts aid workers in harm's way because they're being, you know, attacked severely, and they're unarmed, right? So there's real fear by the UN and the international community of sending their people inside Gaza and also those working inside Gaza to get out of shelters and distribute aid without having some sort of protection. There's also the whole deconfliction issue. It's a war, and, you know, UN workers and shelters are being mistakenly hit. There's a story today about an UNRWA facility that was hit, and reports are mixed, but there are casualties and lots of wounded people. And those things make the delivery of aid and its distribution to beneficiaries, those things really impair them. So in a sense, it's just not enough to open another crossing. We have to think about the whole, if you'd want the humanitarian supply chain. Mm-hmm. And it's impaired along the way. Now, of course, the fighting continues. You have the north part of Gaza, which was sort of emptied out. The IDF urged the population to leave early on and to move south. So you had approximately a million people, a little bit over a million people in the north, and the same number in the south. Now most of the people in the north are in the south. So you had a very small piece of land with no infrastructure, with that was overpopulated and crowded to begin with, now has way more people than it can service. The north itself, according to UN, and I think also IDF estimates, there are around 200,000 people there.
Yep.
I can't even tell you what they're drinking and it's very difficult to get stuff to the north. There are attempts, but it's difficult. And there's some, I heard from UN folks saying, like, how can we send our folks, you know, to go 3 hours in a truck without us being able to know where they are if, cellular networks are down because of, you know, there's been like a mistake and IDF, struck a cable. So it's just extremely, extremely, extremely complicated. And this is where the technical gets mixed with the political, because you could arguably say that once the operation in the north almost ended, right, we're in a different place in the north than we are in the southern part of Gaza, like Khan Yunis, that you will let the people go back home. It will help alleviate pressures in the south. You can do like a damage assessment in the north. You can try to provide some services. In a sense, like the north, in my mind, the North could have been like a model for some sort of a day after now. But for political reasons, you know, the Israeli government doesn't want to allow people to go back north. So it's really not just the technical, it's also the political. And, you know, whether we like it or not, there are 2.2 million Palestinians living there. Lots of women, children, and we are seeing the indicators. I mean, I can throw lots of numbers at you, but we are seeing a very worrying signs of hunger and about pandemics and hepatitis A and risks of other diseases. And the indicators are concerning. And I know it's not like, there are these reports that come out and say like Israel's starving the population. Israel's definitely not starving the population, but there is, as a result of the security situation and the war and the many, many, many constraints to humanitarian relief, there isn't enough food. There isn't enough. There isn't sufficient access to health care facilities, to water and to shelter. And I'm not even starting to speak about like schooling and education. Those things can obviously wait, but the very basic fundamentals that people need to survive are not available.
And just on the topic of, you know, politics being wrapped up in a lot of this, earlier today, there was a protest at the Kerem Shalom crossing between Israel and Gaza by relatives of the hostage families, I think some relatives of fallen soldiers, not allowing the trucks to move into Gaza, the aid trucks, demanding the government take a harder line with regard to the provision of humanitarian aid into Gaza as a, I suppose, a lever against Hamas. And sure, real quick, you know as well as I do that the Israeli side would argue that, well, we're not the bottleneck. We're not the problem here. The UN and the other international aid organizations just have to do more with their operation inside Gaza in order to get more aid to the population.
Yes, yes. And listen, I think Israel and the UN need to go through a process of rapprochement. It's very difficult.
Couples therapy.
Yeah, absolutely, and at all levels, and you know, the fact is that the UN needs Israel, and Israel needs the UN, and I'm not going to go say who needs each other more, but this relationship doesn't make sense, and of course the UN, its initial sort of response and condemnation of Israel, we could speak that the UN definitely has its share of the blame, but I think Israel also has to acknowledge that the expectations of the UN to operate in the conditions in Gaza are extremely, extremely demanding, right? We are making demands of the UN that are not so reasonable. You know, we have over 140 UN workers that have died in the war as a result of, you know, IDF strikes. And I think most, they're local staff, but these are UN workers. Communications is impaired. They have no armed protection. I mean, and this is an active war zone. The UN doesn't have a compound in different parts of the world where there are war zones. The UN operates out of a compound. They don't have a compound in Gaza. So in a sense, we have to acknowledge, and I think it would be good if Israel acknowledges this publicly, to acknowledge that it's very difficult for the UN to do their job. And then the two sides should work together to achieve their interests, because it's not in Israel's interests that there will be even more severe a deterioration in the humanitarian situation in Gaza. And if the UN told Israel the other, you know, one day, like, we had it, we just can't work in these conditions, we're leaving, it's not what Israel wants.
Yeah,
and they would say that. So finding a way to work together, and my fear is that when Israel says, like, oh, we are fine, it's all the UN, the UN can say, well, if you blame it on us, we will tell you that you need to go for a ceasefire, because otherwise we can't do our job. And this is not a productive dialogue. So in a sense, I think it's better to improve the coordination mechanisms and the conversation overall, and finding better ways to do deconfliction to make sure no more aid workers are getting hurt. How do we protect aid better? How do we protect aid workers better? Not just you know, from mistakes done by IDF, and those are all mistakes, but also from looting and from Hamas. Mm-hmm. And there are no easy solutions, but more can be done by both sides on these issues. And by the way, it's not just the UN and Israel. We have now, of course, Ambassador David Satterfield has been a humanitarian envoy of the Biden administration, but not just that. Now many countries have humanitarian envoys, and European countries are involved, and regional countries are involved. So, you know, we can have a multi-stakeholder process of ensuring that that we all work together to provide a better humanitarian relief than there is today.
If I know government bureaucracy, which I don't, I would say there are a lot of cooks in the humanitarian kitchen, but best of luck to them in sorting out the very real situation, as you very succinctly put forward, Shira. So well done. Michael, on the humanitarian situation, we know it's been a major point of emphasis from the Biden administration from the beginning, along with planning by Israel for the quote-unquote day after the war in Gaza, or the day after Hamas in Gaza, along with renewed calls that we're hearing more and more in recent weeks for a commitment, I suppose, by Israel to a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Give us the mood, if you could, sitting in Washington, how the war is being perceived now almost 4 months into the war. Has it changed at all? Are the points of emphasis the same? Are they shifting? What's your take?
I think there are a few things going on. So first of all, everybody can see from the debates that are going on, particularly in the Senate, about conditioning assistance to Israel, that unsurprisingly, the longer the war goes on and the more the Palestinian casualties pile up, the more squeamish folks in D.C. get, particularly folks on the left and folks in the Democratic Party. So that's not surprising. That's something that I think, you know, we're used to seeing in terms of Israel. But I think that's intensified the longer that the war takes place. I think there seems to be a determination that Israel has indeed shifted to a lower intensity phase of the war, and that's measured in all sorts of ways. certainly from all of the reservists who've returned home, and fewer airstrikes. And even there was a New York Times report just a couple of days ago about how Palestinian casualty numbers have really dropped over the last month. So I think that as that has happened, more of the focus has been on this humanitarian situation, especially because I think a lot of folks in DC feel that Israel is going to do what it's going to do in terms of the war itself. And there's not a lot that anybody can do here to shift that Israeli calculus. But then when it comes to things like humanitarian assistance, that's a place where it's easier to try to put pressure on Israel to get it to cooperate in more effective ways. So at the moment, I think that that's where a lot of the conversation is, just because that is seen as something that the U.S. can impact. And indeed, it's important to point out that for all the criticism that Israel is either ignoring the United States or that the Biden administration doesn't have any real power to shift Israeli behavior, when it comes to the humanitarian things, and you know, this is something that I've heard Shira point out in different venues a bunch. Ultimately, what the U.S. has asked for is gotten, whether it has been more trucks going in or opening up Kerem Shalom.
Fuel.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
Fuel.
Right.
Israel refused to provide fuel for a long time at the beginning.
Ashdod flour to Ashdod port is still like happening, but yeah.
Right. So clearly not everything the U.S. has asked for, you know, has happened, and it certainly doesn't happen right away. But the U.S. does seem to have, I should say the Biden administration seems to have a decent track record when it tells Israel to do something on the humanitarian front, it seems to generally get done. So I think that that's also why we're seeing this push toward solving the humanitarian situation, and there's been a lot of focus on that. Now, you also mentioned the two-state part of this, and if there are administration folks who are listening to us, and let's hope that there are.
I think that there are.
I think that there are as well. you know, the administration has been pushing on the two-state language, and we saw it really cause this public spat over the weekend, where Netanyahu said what he said last Thursday in his press conference, and then he spoke to Biden, and Biden the next day told reporters that Netanyahu hadn't ruled out a Palestinian state, that it was really just about how you conceive of it in terms of security control. And then Netanyahu tweeted, no, security control is incompatible with a Palestinian state. And then he recorded a video where he didn't say it quite as explicitly, and maybe that was a step back. The thing is that this is a losing argument inside of Israel. It's not only Netanyahu, Israelis in general, certainly since October 7th, you say two states, people just shut you out. And that's going to be the case if you had Prime Minister Benny Gantz. I think that would be the case if you had Prime Minister Gadi Eisenkot or Yair Lapid. It's one thing to talk about things that you can do now to set a pathway or to create a horizon. I think that these are formulations that Israelis can live with, but talking about two states without qualifiers and expecting any Israeli prime minister to right now come out and say, sure, that's a vision I support, it's not going to work. It's not going to work, and I think it's going to turn off many Israelis. So I think it's important, clearly, to work on the specific issues, to create a political horizon, to create a new pathway toward a possible two-state future. And of course, this isn't just about Gaza. It necessarily involves changes in the West Bank. And I think that it will only be successful if you also wrap it in with a regional process. And of course, we've seen messaging from the region, particularly from the Saudis over the past couple of weeks, that talks about this exactly, that they want to be helpful and they want to normalize with Israel and they want to engage, but that it can only come in the context of irreversible steps toward a pathway to Palestinian statehood. So I think that that's what the U.S. should be working on. It should be working on how to get to those irreversible steps. But I think that the kind of in-your-face language on two states, as much as I support it as a vision, I worry is going to backfire inside of Israel and make the steps that have to be taken even more difficult. Because we all know that a lot of these steps that should be taken can be done in a relatively quiet fashion without much fanfare. But if folks on the right, and certainly the far right in Israel, can place any U.S. request in the context of they're trying to create a Palestinian state under our nose, that's going to make almost anything harder. So I think that I would love to see the administration turn down the volume on the rhetoric on this, but really turn up the heat on Israel in terms of tangible steps that need to be taken now to help make solving Gaza easier and to help make a regional process easier and to help empower the Palestinian Authority and find some way out of this mess.
So I agree with everything you just said. And also we should mention for our listeners, especially those, say, in the DMV area listening to us, that every time there's a report or even a statement by an American media outlet or quoting American officials or even an American official saying it on the record that about two states, it only serves Netanyahu's political purposes. He's actually very happy to see those statements because it gives him something to run against.
Yes.
And so we should be very clear about that. Having said all that, you lay out, I think, what we can call a structural problem here, where in order to get buy-in from the Arab states, from the region, and also to a certain extent from the Palestinian Authority, you need to put forward a positive vision, i.e. two states, in order for them to at least maybe deign to help out with the day after in Gaza. So I don't know how you square that circle in terms of not putting forward a positive vision because of Israeli politics, but also needing to put forward a positive vision in terms of the actual Gaza campaign.
I think it can be hedged. And frankly, other parties in the region are hedging it more than we in the United States are. So if you look at the language coming from the Saudis, they're not saying no normalization without a Palestinian state being created. They're talking about a pathway toward it, you know, and they talk about irreversible steps in that pathway. But they're hedging it more in a way that I think, A, is more palatable to Israeli ears, and B, doesn't create an incentive for people in Israel to immediately push back on it or dismiss it or use it as a campaign issue. So I'm not saying that the U.S. shouldn't put forth a vision. I'm saying that it should be a bit more sensitive to the political discourse inside of Israel, well, always, but certainly since October 7th, and couch what it wants to do in ways that don't kind of ignite the hackles of the Israeli right so easily. Because you are correct. I think that every time it happens, they're giving Netanyahu a real gift. He would absolutely love to have an election that is not about October 7th, but is about whether the U.S. is going to cram a Palestinian state down Israelis' throats. That's like his dream election, given everything that's going on. So why give him that opportunity? Why not instead hedge things a bit and ask the Israeli government to take steps that are moving toward that vision that the U.S. wants to see, but don't do it in such a public way that gives the Israeli right fodder to push back on quite so easily.
Shira, what do you think about all of the above? And also, what would those irreversible steps, as Michael mentioned, or at least steps to empower or strengthen the Palestinian Authority, what would they actually look like?
I mean, first of all, you know, I agree with Michael, and I just understand the administration's considerations, but it just sounds tone deaf here. And really, no one's talking about, you know, IPF is an organization that, you know, two states is on the business card, and we're not talking about two states at the moment. So not just because of Israeli politics, because it's just not in the card at the moment. Clearly, we could talk about, you know, a political vision. This has to be part of it. And I think there's so much that the U.S. can be doing and not just dangling the two states and using this terminology for all the reasons that we discussed.
Just by the way, I want to make clear, you know, for anybody who's listening and Peter Shira or me, IPF 1,000% still supports a two-state outcome to the Israeli-Palestinian
yes,
conflict.
Yes,
it's of course what we are working toward, and I'm pretty sure always will, or at least until we get there. But again, there's a difference between the ultimate vision and working toward it, and talking about it in this political moment in a way that's counterproductive. So just so that there's no ambiguity for anyone who's listening.
It's a good interjection, Michael. Shira, sorry, we cut you off.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. So I agree, but there's so much to do, right? There's so much to do, regardless, because let's be frank, right? We are talking about some sort of day after situation in Gaza. We're talking about having a Palestinian led or Palestinian government, and you know, we spoke about in our previous podcast, but what kind of like provisional government would look like. How do you sort of bring the PA back to Gaza? And even if, you know, Meretz was the head of the, you know, Zehava Galon of Meretz was prime minister of Israel. Now it's not like the Abu Mazen would roll into Gaza and create a Palestinian state. There are inherent weaknesses to the Palestinian Authority. They're basically can't even, we say it all the time, but they can't govern, you know, Jenin and Nablus, let alone Gaza. So there's so many things that need to be done, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, and regionally, to create sort of pave the way to get there. I think the conversation about the revitalized Palestinian Authority, you know, it was a new term coined by the president in an op-ed. Now it mm-hmm. got an acronym, so it's real, right? RPA. I think that's actually, in my view, it's really positive because it speaks about those overdue reforms of the Palestinian Authority and telling them, you know, you were for years part of the problem and you have a chance of becoming the solution or part of the solution, but only if you get your act together and we will help you do that. It doesn't, I'm putting Israel aside, but there's so much work that can be done in terms of the overdue reforms of the Palestinian Authority. Normalization is still, you know, very much on the table, tying this to some sort of a solution in Gaza. I am leaving aside Palestinian reconciliation, which is likely going to be need to be part of it, but we're not talking about it at the moment. This is where I would push both the Palestinians, and frankly, I would also push Israel on that, right? If the U.S. says, okay, we have to reform the PA because we all complain that they're inept and corrupt and unable to govern. Okay, we will pressure them to do these. And it starts with, you know, there's the political component, and, you know, I can, give you like a taste of what it looks like in my view, but this is not gonna, the PA cannot do this alone. They need regional support. They need European support. They need American support, and they need Israel to enable these reforms. You cannot speak about like changing, you know, fiscal files and doing better collection of taxes and creating more conducive environments for the development of a private sector without Israel alleviating the many constraints and maybe reopening of the Paris Protocol, which was, you know, negotiated as part of the Oslo Agreement. Like this, for the real reforms of the Palestinian Authority, I think Israel would have to play ball. And this is below the threshold of the two-state solution. As long as we are still in this paradigm, and we are in the Oslo paradigm, as much as the prime minister loves to say that he killed Oslo, I've never received the memo, let's say. Oslo officially has not been killed. And so we are still in this paradigm, right? There's still like a political arrangement that allows this. And there's a lot that can be done without talking about necessarily only a two-state solution, but just creating those conditions. And it seems that the administration could be serious about it, and they have all the backing, the regional backing that they need. And I hope they will receive Israeli backing as well if they encourage it.
And that will likely entail or necessitate a new Israeli government. I don't see this current Israeli government doing much, if anything, on this file. And we should say Bibi Netanyahu tried to kill the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but at the end, you can say the Israeli-Palestinian conflict likely killed him politically.
Yeah, well, so, we never know. You know, with Netanyahu, we never know who's going to kill.
Yeah, I know.
Who's going to kill him?
Even Tal Shalev in the last episode wouldn't rule out Netanyahu somehow getting out of this political jam and surviving.
But I don't want to mean, I think for the real overhaul reforms, Israel would have to play ball. But there are a lot of things that the Palestinian Authority can do now, even if Israel continues, you know, with this its intransigence and refusing to participate in this process and enable. There are a lot of things that can happen domestically. And a lot of painful decisions and brave decisions that the Palestinians themselves would have to make, even regardless of Israel. And there's no, we can't wait for the day after Netanyahu to begin all these processes in the region.
I agree. A lot that they can do, a lot that they should do. We're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. Like we said at the top, a lot of ground to cover, a lot of topics. We could have used another hour, but we'll save it for next time. So with that, Michael, Shira, thank you both as always. Michael, I'll likely see you here on the ground, or we'll both likely see you here on the ground next week. So safe travels.
Thank you. Actually, I think Shira and I will be crossing in the air. I'm going there and she's coming here, but you, I will definitely see.
The Holy Land isn't big enough for the both of you. I see how
exactly.
It is. Exactly. Well, till you meet again. Thank you both.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Henry.
Good night.
Okay, thanks again to Michael Koplow and Shir Efron, as always, for their generous time and insights. Also, a special thanks to our producer, Jacob Gilman, and to all of you who support Israel Policy Forum's work. Do consider making a donation to Israel Policy Forum so it can keep being a credible source of analysis and ideas on issues such as these that we all care deeply, deeply about, including this podcast. And most importantly, thank you for listening.